I kind of feel like at the moment, like in Australia, it's kind of time for gay men at least to kind of pass the mic down the line. And that's kind of not happening at the moment. It feels like there's a lack of generosity in terms of the people who do have power within there. Like there's a lack, I feel like there's a lack of listening.
I'm Ben Nielsen, and this is LGBTI Q&A, conversations with leaders who happen to be queer. I first saw one of Declan Greene's plays in 2014 at the Sydney Theatre Company. At the time, I didn't quite know what to make of it. It was witty, absurd, and a bit glam grunge. Apparently, this has always been Declan's style, though, even when he was a kid. Declan says he was pretty queeny, even though he grew up in an Irish Catholic family in conservative rural Victoria.
I was like pretty clearly a little flamer from a pretty young age. I was like a little cross-dresser. I was literally a friend of Dorothy. I was obsessed with The Wizard of Oz, like completely infatuated with it. And I used to dress up as Dorothy and the witch. I was kind of really, I thought they were equally fabulous. I love both of them. I love the witch's green skin and I love Dorothy's ruby slippers. And so my parents, and I was just also extremely effeminate. So I think my parents kind of cottoned on that something was up with me kind of from a pretty young age. I guess maybe that was also part of the extent to which they kind of shielded me from the bigger kind of religious aspects to my extended family and stuff like that. But
did they also shield you from the conservatism of rural Victoria?
Yeah, like there were. I mean, I was bullied in high school for being really queeny, but I did grow up in rural Victoria, but I was also kind of a bully as well. Like I guess as a kind of like coping mechanism, I developed a pretty nasty tongue, and as much as I was being kind of bullied for or being called a faggot or whatever on a regular basis, I really started kind of laying into kids who were weaker than me or I thought not as smart as me. But I only mention this in the context of my parents because the kind of probably the place I experienced most bullying was on the school bus. I spent nearly an hour on the bus every day going to school and going back and then another hour coming back from school every day. And the school bus was really nasty. Like it was kind of like packed with kids from all different schools. And that was kind of where I copped at the worst. And I eventually told my parents after years and years and years that I couldn't really handle the bus anymore. And they moved me onto a different bus.
What was happening on the bus?
I guess it was... I mean, the hard thing about the school bus is that you're trapped there. You can't do anything about it, and it's a really unregulated environment. So I don't know. It was just kind of like pretty standard, basic taunting. Just
physical as well?
No, I mean, I was never beaten up on the bus or anything like that. I don't think you could get that far. You couldn't really, because there was always the mirror up the front in the school. The bus driver could, I guess, see what was kind of going on. But I do remember on my final day on the bus, I was getting off and the bus driver knew, obviously, that he wasn't supposed to pick me up anymore because the bus used to come right outside our house. And he said to me, couldn't hack it anymore, could you? Like,
in a kind way?
No, or? Not at all. Oh, like, as in, like I was weak. Like, after years, I was just like, it was really just something I should have been putting up with. It was amazing to me because I'd always just, he was such a nice, kindly old man, and I'd always thought he just didn't notice. Like, I always thought he just had no idea what was going on the bus. But
what does that say about authority figures who can intervene? Isn't that terrible?
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, I think there's also kind of like a real Australian kind of stoicism that goes along with, particularly in rural Victoria.
This is character just
like,
building.
It's character building and it's a rite of passage or something like that. And I don't know, like also to him, like maybe he didn't even think I was gay. Maybe it was just for him. It was just, I was just being called a poof or called a fairy or called a faggot or whatever. And that was just like, just about the fact that I was obviously a beta male compared to the other guys who were on the bus.
And so when did that switch? When did you become the harasser?
I reckon maybe in year 10, I reckon. So I was kind of, I think I got to a point where it happened within like a friendship group at the school initially, but I just kind of realized that within group dynamics, I could with whatever small amount of power I could accrue because I was because I had wit or because I was kind of sharp, that I could kind of wield words in a way that meant that I could experience power. I could actually feel powerful. And so I kind of did that, and it was always within the sense of it was never like I was physically attacking kids, and it was never like I was they were always kids who are actually within my friendship group, who I would have kind of end up having kind of like a frenemy relationship with, but who I would then kind of slowly, it was much more cruel and much more kind of manipulative and gaslighty and nasty, like kind of in that sense.
It's kind of like that sibling rivalry, I suppose. Did you ever feel the need to atone for the things that you'd said?
I mean, I do now, definitely. Well, I mean, probably personally as well, really, if I tracked down, it was mainly one person. If I tracked him down, I actually think about that quite often, that I should, but I feel such a deep shame about it. I feel like it's something I haven't quite really confronted yet.
Do you think he's aware of you now? What you're doing, who you are, where you are?
I don't know. Yeah, I've got no idea. I have absolutely no idea what's become of him whatsoever. I don't know. I'm sure he would hate me, like as much as I hated all the kids who were horrible to me as well. I feel like it's probably something that, you know, in retrospect, I look back on it and it's behavior that I'm very conscious to avoid repeating again. And I think also when I'm in situations of power, like I work as a director now a lot, and I'm very, very conscious of dynamics of power and how they occur in rooms. And I'm very, very conscious to avoid any situation where I feel like I'm wielding power in a way that has an element of cruelty to or anything like that to it. Like the rooms I run are very kind of very democratic and very open and very kind of conversational. And yeah, that kind of behavior is definitely something I try and avoid now.
How did you internalize the homophobia that you experienced?
I never felt like in my home life, and this is pretty remarkable, but like particularly given where I grew up and also my parents' upbringing as Irish Catholics, I never really felt like I was anything other than myself when I was at home with my parents. I was like I said, I was extremely queenie. I was also just like a hyper emotional child, like throwing tantrums all the time, like just an absolute sook. And like anything would set me off, and like putting on plays for my family and upset, like building little worlds, like obsessing over Lego and things like that. Like, and I never really felt like I had to suppress that at all. And I also was completely unconscious of it being anything other than the norm. Like I think it was actually probably not until I got to high school. Like literally, I think I spent all of primary school still thinking that there was nothing exceptional about the way. And when I look back on it as well, my very best friend at primary school, this guy called Michael, was clearly like a huge flamer as well. Like we just found each other and spent every moment together and were obsessed with the Spice Girls. And nobody remarked on this being in any way strange.
And looking back on it now, surely you realize that that is unusual. You know?
Yeah, of course. It was really strange, I'm sure. And even like in terms of our parents, friends and like our wider social world, it was actually kind of remarkable that no one ever, even at primary school, we were never bullied for being different. We were actually kind of, we weren't popular, but we were just accepted for whatever we were, which was kind of amazing. And then when I reached high school, I realized that actually I was I was definitely not the norm at all, and felt that very, very kind of, very clearly. But I remember in high school, I also, like as soon as I started being called a faggot or being called a poof or whatever, I immediately attempted to kind of suppress that and started kind of trying to butch up a little bit, which was in retrospect pretty horrifying to think of. I mean, just in terms of how appalling a performance that would have been. And also became like, did the whole like homophobia thing. I was like, I hate poofs, like don't call me a poof, like I'd be the last person to be a poof because they're disgusting. And I remember seeing like I had these really complex feelings about the band Placebo. I'm sure if you remember them, like, yeah, Brian Molko.
What were the complex feelings?
Yeah, well, only that they were probably the first like openly gay people I'd kind of experienced in terms of in pop culture, like the fact that he was bisexual and Stefan, the bassist Stefan, was gay. And I just remember like loving their music and feeling really like when I found out that they were gay, like I knew that they were obviously kind of femme presenting and quite androgynous, all of them in their appearance, which I was kind of fine with because at the time I really loved Marilyn Manson and I'd loved David Bowie and stuff like that as well. But I remember being like really disgusted by that and being like finding that like actually really deeply repellent.
But also it was alluring at the same time.
Yeah, totally. So it was really kind of this odd kind of complex thing where, I mean, I feel like a lot of the time that kind of that narrative around discovering the first kind of gay celebrity or person in your kind of in your pop cultural vocabulary or your cultural world that's gay is usually kind of this huge sense of relief. And for me, it was just like horror. I was just like, that's vile. That's disgusting. Even though I knew I was gay at that point, it was, yeah, really, really odd.
Declan befriended a group of older girls at high school. He describes them as Daria-esque because they listened to Tori Amos and wrote each other poetry. The older girls soon graduated, and Declan was left behind at school without any friends. He found sanctuary in theatre, and at the end of year 12, decided to enrol in theatre at university, but he only lasted 6 months.
And I just like hated it. I absolutely hated it.
Why did you hate it?
I think I felt like it was really disconnected from what I actually, from my interest in theatre. And that was no fault of the course. It was just that it was like an academic engagement with it. So it was kind of all critical theory. I think maybe I was also just a little bit arrogant and I thought that like everyone was really untalented and I was amazing. And it was also something about the fact that it was really unchallenging. Like the course was unchallenging. So I left the course and then I think it closed down about a year later or 2 years later or something anyway. And I did art history instead. And I really loved it, which was bizarre because I'd hated studying critical theory in terms of theatre, but I loved it in terms of art. And I found performance art incredibly interesting just to study and to write about. I know that was kind of when I first started reading queer theory and feminist theory. And the stuff that was really kind of interesting and formative in terms of creating a political perspective. But at the same time, I was doing a comedy festival show with a friend of mine, and we decided to put something in the comedy festival, and I auditioned an actor named Ash Flanders, and he was incredibly hilarious, and we got along really, really well, and we did this really bad comedy festival show, which got reviews by no one, and no one came. It was absolutely awful, but he and I kind of got along amazingly well and formed this friendship, which has still been going on for 12 years now. And we decided we were going to make a theatre company together, which was called Sisters Grimm. And we were both kind of like babies at the time. We didn't really know who we were or what we were. And I don't think we really understand who we were as gay men yet either. Ash was a few years older than me. So he was kind of like a few steps ahead of me in terms of working out his identity. So he kind of, I don't know, mentored me to an extent as well. But we sort of grew up together. Like, I mean, we were already, I think I was 19 at the time and he was maybe 24 or something like that.
Why did you decide to listen to Ash and his advice, but potentially not many other people? You've said before that you don't take advice very well.
I don't know. Like when Ash and I met, I had a very kind of rigid idea of what I thought gay culture was. And it was completely inherited through things like watching like Queer as Folk on SBS late at night and watching the Mardi Gras on Channel 10. And I hadn't really dug a lot deeper than that. So like the idea of going to a gay bar was completely repellent to me. And I like all I thought kind of associated gay culture with was like kind of like spray tans and Carson Kreisley. And that wasn't me at all. Like at the time I was interested in punk and I was interested in DIY and kind of the aesthetics of DIY, like the idea of I liked things that were scrappy and unfinished, and that was reflected in the music I was listening to and the people who I was friends with. So when I met Ash was somebody who had a really formed gay identity in a way that I hadn't. I mean, he still has grown a lot since then, but the way he understood gay culture was in a way that I had never really heard articulated before. Like, he was this kind of like lover of kind of broken camp. Like, he was, he kind of made me remember how much I used to love Judy Garland and The Wizard of Oz when I was a kid, which is something I'd been embarrassed about at that point. But it kind of helped me rediscover that. And he loved Dolly Parton and loved, and it was funny, he'd been mentored by another gay person who was older than him, who'd kind of like, kind of ignited his love for like, you know, Romy and Michelle on VHS. And I don't know, this is this kind of world of kind of alternative camp or whatever, where, and the fact that I'd loved like PJ Harvey and Hole and Courtney Love and people like that when I was a teenager, like I hadn't really understood that as being a camp or a gay thing at the time. But the fact that Ash was like, yeah, I love Courtney Love, she's amazing, she's totally camp, like it kind of helped me kind of recognize the bits of my life that I had gravitated towards because of my queer identity, that I actually thought had just been punk or something. I didn't understand how punk and camp could actually like really comfortably sit hand in hand together. And then he and I discovered John Waters together. We'd never seen a John Waters film before. And that was really, really major for us, kind of discovering Divine and Mink Stole and Mary Vivian Pierce and that kind of world of, there was something about the family building in terms of the Dreamlanders there as well, and the idea that you could actually choose your family, you could kind of create these outlaw worlds of political difference and rage and anger and disenfranchisement that felt really kind of powerful to us. So that was kind of, I think that's what Ash kind of helped me learn.
So his influence spoke to you on a very personal level, really.
Yeah.
Who speaks to you at a professional level?
Well, for a really long time, I don't think I had anybody who spoke to me on a professional level as well. Like, I think it was also part of Ash and I and the theatre company. When we formed Sisters Grimm, we had this idea that there was kind of a punk ethos that was there at the core of it in terms of creating something that was in opposition to what was happening in theatre in Melbourne at the time, which was really about kind of like knee-jerk responsiveness to national politics. So there was kind of a lot of theatre about like important and issues like kind of, you know, the Howard government and the refugee crisis and things like that at the time, which were really important. But the work that was kind of being created was very kind of literal and very kind of like straight up naturalism or like it felt like the message was more important than the telling of it. So we kind of decided that we were going to create work that was incredibly nihilistic, that had absolutely no point. And we thought at the time as well, no politic at all. It was just like going to be angry and dumb and camp and as like blindingly offensive as possible. Like when I think back on some of the things we did in some of those early shows, like I blushed, like it was horrifying. And they were going to be done in found spaces and they were just going to be cast like, again, in terms of John Waters and that kind of world building, they were just cast with our friends and people who weren't actors and who were just personalities or people we knew from the club scene or wherever. And that was kind of, and so we existed in complete opposition to places like the MTC and the Malthouse. We had no relationship with them. We never even invited them to come and see our shows.
Hated you probably.
Yeah, but they did. And like, there were funny things that happened later on with companies like one MTC and... once threatened to sue us because we parodied one of their shows. I didn't really have a professional mentor and that was sort of the point of what we were doing. We kind of felt like we didn't actually want any connection to the theatre world. And we had no connection, even in terms of the theatre community, we had no connection to anybody in the theatre community at all. So it probably wasn't until much, much further down the track that I kind of really actually had a theatre mentor.
Do you think you're straddling becoming a mentor yourself? I mean, you're about to give a lecture at the university.
It's actually really weird. Like I've kind of been doing teaching things and mentorships for quite a while now. And it happened really quickly. Like it happened, I think, after I had my first play on Moth. And I think there was
Were you prepared for it?
No, not at all. Like, not even remotely. Because I've never received formal training in playwriting or directing or anything like that. Like, everything I feel like I know, I learned from working with directors, and also I learned from audiences just by putting plays on and feeling the temperature, learning to read the temperature of a room, and learning kind of through watching audiences, like, how to pace my work and how to work with rhythm. And that was all on the job learning. So the experience of having to teach and mentor and work as a dramaturg, like a play editor, which I do very often now, that's actually half of what my job is at the Malthouse at the moment. It was kind of actually this process of actually having to sit down and figure out what I actually do know, and figure out how to kind of put that into words or into lessons that can be kind of communicated, or workshops or things like that. And I'm not a very good teacher, like, at all. And I find the experience of kind of talking about my own practice, it's probably actually just genuinely a self-confidence thing. I find the idea of standing in front of a classroom or even being in a workshop situation and having to pretend that I know what I'm doing really difficult, because I don't know what I'm doing most of the time. Like, I feel out of my depth almost constantly as an artist. Because that's kind of what I'm addicted to about being an artist. That's what I like about it. I don't like returning to the same set of knowns over and over again. Every project I'm doing, hopefully I'm acquiring a new skill set, or I'm engaging in a new exploration, or I'm building a completely new world that I haven't been in before, or that I'm learning how to make.
You're listening to LGBTI Q&A, conversations with leaders who happen to be queer.
Declan's farcical play, The Homosexuals or Faggots, takes a potshot at gay culture, and more specifically, the inner urban gay elite. It's outrageous and offensive, asking a series of provocative questions by holding up a mirror to its audience. Declan says that it was the most difficult work that he's ever written.
In the writing of the play, there's this fairly big question in the work about gay, white, cis male privilege, and about the kind of the ascendancy of gay men within kind of pre-existing kind of heteronormative structures of power. And the way that gay voices kind of take up a lot of airtime in the kind of national conversation compared to other voices in the LGBTIQA community. A huge part of the work is also about call-out culture and offence, and who has the right to offend, and who has the right to take offence, who has the right to say what value is there in freedom of speech. There was an attempt in the work to ask that through a series of very, very kind of provocative questions and a lot of very provocative comedy, and through effectively creating situations of extreme offence that in an attempt to kind of polarise the audience or kind of force them into particular camps, or to try and defy dogmatic ways of thinking in terms of politics. So it was weird. It was like effectively trying to write a work of grey areas where I didn't want the play to be able to be easily called like okay or woke or politically correct at all. Like, I really wanted to make sure it was a lot more incendiary than that, but I also kind of wanted to make sure that the work kind of was on the side of the angels. Like, I wanted to make sure that a clear political line could be kind of drawn through the work, and I didn't want it to be centrist either. So it was just, and also attempting to sit inside that work as a gay white cis man, figuring out what I have the right to say and what I don't have the right to say. And often in the work, I was writing things that I don't feel I have the right to say. So it was kind of this very kind of complex thing where I was kind of often in the same situation as the characters in the play, going, actually, should I say this? Should I not say this? What are the political implications of me saying this? And also if saying this in a public forum that I have been afforded, or that I've been given, at least in part, because of certain privileges that I have enjoyed because of my identity.
And how did it go down? Because I go to the theatre and you see a lot of old white gay cis men.
Yeah, yeah.
How did they respond?
Well, it's interesting. The play just opened in Sydney, in Griffin Theatre, which is in Darlinghurst. I don't read reviews of my plays until months after they've been on.
And I tell you what a review said? It said it was essential queer theatre.
Okay.
So what makes it so essential?
Look, like, I always think that, for me, queer theatre is, like, I mean, just in terms of the word queer, like, it's about kind of destabilizing established categories of being and thinking and identifying. I think of it as being kind of about betweenness. And I always think of queer as kind of being the same as punk as well. Like, it's actually not a fixed category. It's something that exists in opposition to whatever's happening in mainstream culture at the time. So I think that in terms of the homosexuals being a queer work, it's something that actually sits against the mainstreaming of gay culture. I feel like actually, like, they're like slowly and inevitably men like me will be kind of kicked out of queerness.
The term's changing so much and it encompasses so many different things.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't like to be queer yourself, do you?
No, I do. I mean, I love the term queer. It's what I call myself, but actually I'm becoming less and less comfortable with calling myself queer because I'm actually starting to feel like the term is moving on from what it was even 5 years ago or 4 years ago. I feel like actually, you know, at the moment I feel like queer is actually about what sits between pre-established categories of identity and binary thinking as well. I feel like queerness has become increasingly associated with the idea of non-binary, in terms of gender and in terms of sexuality and in terms of a racial politic as well. It's which I think is like genuinely revolutionary and like so, so, so important. And but yeah, but that's, I guess, also why I feel like as a white cis guy who sleeps exclusively with men, it's maybe actually not for me anymore and I need to leave it behind and accept that actually I'm just gay. And maybe that's okay.
Your work is a lot about offending people, whether or not you're intentionally trying to do that. What offends you?
Laziness. Laziness offends me. Yeah, that's like lazy thinking really offends me. And I think that's actually part of where the homosexuals came from. I find the kind of increasingly partisan nature of political debate in this country really enraging and offensive. Like, and the way that that has kind of infected political thinking in this country, not only like in terms of on a national kind of like parliamentary level, but then also in terms of how conversation and activism is kind of carried out in the LGBTIQA community as well. I find it really enraging that we've become so entrenched in dogmatic ways of thinking that complexity of thought is, and the idea that arguments might require context or time or a sense of evolution to be properly articulated or to kind of like reach their zenith is completely disregarded. Like I find that really hard. And also the idea that artworks and human beings can be just kind of like exiled and are like slapped with the label problematic and turned away with no hope of exoneration. I want to say no scope for apology, but then like the idea that actually the debate can't continue unless an apology has been made, and the idea that hurt feelings are such a currency at the moment, I find difficult. And I also find that difficult to reconcile in terms of sensitivities around who is hurt more often than other people and the way that intersects with ideas of privilege. Like that, it's incredibly, incredibly complex stuff. But at the same time, I feel like the complexity of it isn't actually really acknowledged or even really makes its way into the conversation. It feels like often it's just like whoever is the most pissed off or manages to, whoever, who like the person with who is the most pissed off with the biggest number of Twitter followers is the person who wins the argument. And so I think that's it. I think laziness really pisses me off. And also in terms of if I work with people, if I find somebody isn't, I'm a crazy person and I throw a lot of myself into my work. And if I collaborate with people who won't meet me halfway or won't kind of come sit at my table, my crazy, crazy table.
You cut them out.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Like it's you've got to really want to do this. Also, like theatre is a fairly miserable profession financially. Like it's hard to make a living and you don't do it unless you really, really love it. Nobody's doing this for the money at all unless they're making like big musicals or something like that. But so I'm always just like, if you're not going to work hard, And like, if you don't love it enough, just don't do it, because there are other people who will work hard and who will who do love it more.
What do you think is wrong with the gay community? Is it that we're fighting for the wrong causes?
Like I said, I think it is this like partisanship in thought. And I was going, this is going to sound deeply hypocritical because of everything I've just said, but it's also the fact that we are so divided. Like, it feels like and in part that's because there's a lack of generosity in terms of the people who do have power within there. Like, there's a lack, I feel like there's a lack of listening and a lack of willingness to kind of concede or acquiesce platforms. Like, I kind of feel like at the moment, like in Australia, it's kind of time for gay men at least to kind of pass the mic down the line, and that's kind of not happening at the moment. And also that extreme, the fact that people just actually just can't seem to get along at the moment, or the way that argument can't be conducted in a way that's kind of respectful.
Do you think your theatre work is changing that?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think theatre changes anything. Like, I'm not.
Why
do
you do it then?
I think the theatre has the potential to make people ask questions. Whenever I work as a dramaturg, my kind of like foundation, this is kind of what I think I've learned as well, like in terms of the foundation of my practice and also what I try and impart to anybody who I mentor or teach, is that theatre is about a dialogue and it's about a forum. Every work that creates, I think, needs to have a really strong question that it's asking, not a statement that it's making. Like, it's not a lecture, it's not an article, it's not an essay. Like, all you have is a viewpoint that you want to foist on people, then become a politician, don't become an artist. So everything I make, I'm trying to ask a question to the audience, or I'm trying to ask a series of questions, and it's very important to me that those questions don't have answers. I don't know what the answers are. And even better, it's even better if they're questions that don't have answers whatsoever. So really all I'm hoping with the work I make is that it encourages questioning, and that it sparks really good and robust conversation in the foyer after the show, and the people will go home and continue talking about it, and that they might it might inspire curiosity. I think that's all it can do. But I think that anybody goes to see a play and has a eureka moment and goes, wow, like my mind has been completely changed politically. Like, it's such a slow process. I don't even know if it is possible to change somebody's mind once they're past a certain age. Like, I think we get very entrenched and very trapped into particular ways of thinking. And I think that the way that social media kind of orients and kind of cloisters us within particular bubbles is only making that more and more kind of fixed.
You're very young. You're 32.
Yeah.
How will you change in the next few years?
I don't know. I could never. I have a real problem with long-term thinking. Like, I never know where I'm going to be. I don't have a career path at all. Like, I don't. I have interests that I have at the time that send me or ignite me or send me in particular little directions in terms of politics or art or whatever. So I don't know. Like, I might not even be making theatre in a few years' time. Even in terms of like my gay identity, like kind of like or where I am. Kind of, yeah, sitting as a human being. Like, I 5 years ago I was still drinking so much and clubbing and partying really, really heavily, and like in this kind of like intense, quite self-destructive kind of period of my life that was incredibly fun, like hugely fun. And if you had told me then that in 5 years time I would have a job, like a full-time job working for a theater company, and have a boyfriend and like actually go to the gym, like that would be like, not only would I think it was ridiculous, I would find it repellent. I would have been like, that's fucking disgusting. Like, that's so boring and ridiculous. So I don't know, like, I feel like anything could be possible in 5 years. Like, might be able to be a Catholic priest in 5 years. Like, it's I've got absolutely no idea. Yeah, I don't know. I'm very impulsive, and I'm very I guess I just don't know.
I'm so glad I managed to track you down, Declan. It's been great.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
My conversation with Declan Green was recorded at the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne. LGBTIQ&A is supported by Pride in Diversity, the national not-for-profit employer support program for LGBTI workplace inclusion, organisational change and workplace diversity. You can find out more at prideindiversity.com.au. Next on LGBTIQ&A.
These are the two amazing days in your life. The day you're born and the day you realise why. And this is my realisation of why.